I hear so many times, both in startups and bigger companies, oh, we have a sales execution issue. If your early sales team is not successful, it's never the sales team. It's always the product. Where bigger companies have built new products, they've probably taken it to market too soon. And the salespeople will take it to a mature account. It won't be as mature as the other products. The customer will complain. The salespeople will hate it. It'll get a bad name and then it'll get killed. Which is why you've got to sort of keep it a secret till you've got the MVP. Then work with a small set of customers and set the right expectation. But when you get it right, you've immediately got a distribution channel that you can scale. But if you get it wrong, you'll never scale it, and you'll just create a whole bunch of problems in your customer base.
Hello and welcome to the Engineering Leadership Podcast, brought to you by ELC, the engineering leadership community.
I'm Jerry Lee, founder of ELC,
and I'm Patrick Gallagher, and we're your hosts. Our show shares the most critical perspectives, habits, and examples of great software engineering leaders to help evolve leadership in the tech industry. In this episode, Jeremy Burton, CEO at Observe, joins us to discuss translating leadership skills from large-scale organizations to small, early-stage startups. We compare Jeremy's experiences operating at scale with over 13,000 people to 10-person startups. And in our conversation, we cover driving innovation at large-scale organizations. We talk about strategies for bringing your engineering teams closer to your customers. We get into leadership characteristics that promote successful scaling, conversation frameworks for creating alignment, building trust with developer communities, and more. Let me introduce you to Jeremy. Prior to Observe, Jeremy was Executive Vice President, Marketing and Corporate Development of Dell Technologies and served in various leadership roles at EMC prior to Dell. He's a 20-year veteran of the IT industry. Jeremy was also President and CEO at Serena Software and led Symantec's $2 billion enterprise security product line as Group President of Security and Data Management. Earlier in his career, he spent nearly a decade at Oracle, where he co-founded and built the largest Oracle community on the internet, Oracle Technology Network, or OTN, growing it from zero to over 2 million members. And I think OTN now has over 6 million members involved. Enjoy our conversation with Jeremy Burton. Jeremy, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us on the show today. How are you doing? How are things in your world right now?
Great. I feel a lot better now. I'm just coming to the end of fundraising. We're doing a Series B. And as almost anyone who's been at a startup knows, the sort of B and the C rounds are probably the most difficult because you're not small, but you're not big. You're sort of a tweener. So, but we just wrapped up our fiscal year. Our fiscal year ends end of Jan. And it was a great one. So I'm feeling pretty good right now.
Three big moments and phases sort of ending and kicking off. But I think that's interesting because, you know, I know you and I caught up beforehand and we had a couple ideas for the things that we wanted to get into. And part of it is sort of deconstructing some of the different scales of leadership that you've operated at, both with Observe and in other contexts. And so I think what's special is sort of catching you at the end of this is I imagine there's a lot of like reflection and lessons learned and things that you think about for the future now, of like insights that you're going to apply. So I think it's kind of a cool moment. So I'll just say like, what a fun time to come together. I wanted to set some context for folks listening in. And so I was wondering, you know, if we're going to talk about leadership at different scales, I was wondering if you could maybe introduce us to the scale that you were operating at, maybe at your time at EMC, and some of the core areas of focus that your leadership was focused on then, and maybe how that compares to what you're focused on when you joined Observe.
Yeah, I've been very fortunate throughout my career. In fact, I feel very privileged to have had a career in tech, and I still maintain to this day. I've been doing it a long time, probably almost 30 years now, and it is the greatest industry bar none. And so I've worked in companies many different sizes. EMC, which was, I look back at my time there with great fondness, just the friends and the people I met there. But yeah, that was a big team. I mean, that was probably the biggest team that I've ever ran. We had about 13,000 engineers, all manner of storage devices. But out of the 13,000 engineers, about probably 12,500 of them were software. And a very small portion actually would design the hardware, but many, many different groups in many, many different locations. I think most big companies in this day and age, they're not just all sort of organic at their original headquarters. You acquire companies, you become distributed, and it becomes quite difficult and quite complex to manage. And when I left that in 2018, one of my longtime ambitions had been to go run a startup. And that was primarily because I'd always really worked at bigger companies. And candidly, I never felt I could afford to leave and go to a startup because, you know, I had four kids and colleges, and you actually get paid quite well at the larger companies and sort of cutting your compensation in half to go take a risk with the hope of making more. It always seemed just too risky for me. But I eventually got to the point where I thought, okay, it's now or never. If I don't do it now, I'll never do it. And a good friend of mine from many years ago, a guy called Mike Spicer, who works now at Sutter Hill Ventures, I'd always wanted to do something with Mike. And Mike is certainly a great investor and a great guy to be around, but he's also a great salesperson. And he sold me on a very early stage company. There was literally 10 people at the company. And I was thinking of something maybe a little bit more later stage because, you know, my skills are more like how do we scale an organization? But anyway, Mike is a great salesperson. And I joined Observe with literally just the founding team. Had not really written a line of code in anger. You know, Mike, one line that sticks with me, he said, look, Jeremy, if you get in there now, you're going to understand how and why every decision was made around the product and the architecture. Understanding that history and gaining the trust of the founding team early on is going to be critical. And, you know, if you want to be a great founding CEO, that's the way you got to do it. So I don't know, there's something sort of attractive and romantic about that. So here I am. So yeah, 13,000 people to 10 people was the jumping off point. And I have to say, I've never regretted it for a moment.
Jerry, I see you shaking your head partially in like both disbelief and resonance with both of those different stories or comparisons. What's going through your mind?
It's the sheer contrast of the size of team you're managing and how getting involved in every little details, because it's two very different organizations and the mindset that you use for management is very different. One with many layers in between, from the frontline developers to where you were. Now you're working directly, maybe side by side, coding with the engineers. So I don't know how you adapt.
Yeah,
to that.
You know, the thing is, I feel in hindsight, looking back at my career, I did well at the larger companies because I never really worked through the hierarchy. If I wanted to get something done, I usually would go to the person that was doing the job. And I sort of put this back to my time at Oracle in the late 90s. It was very much a culture of like, you had to be hands-on. Didn't matter what level you were at, you had to roll up your sleeves and do work. Some might say that would encourage like micromanagement at times. And I think that's probably correct. I definitely at certain points in my career felt like burned out because I was probably trying to do the work of my team as well as manage the team. But I've always been very hands-on. There's maybe this innate fear that I had growing up in the UK in the 80s when there was big unemployment. You always have this innate fear of being laid off. And so you always have this desire to retain your skills and work hard. And hey, if anything ever happens, I'm going to be okay. So I've always been that way. I've always been wired to be hands-on. And now I think it actually helped me when I moved to Observe, because obviously at a startup, if you don't touch something, it doesn't move, right? And it was quite refreshing to be very involved and to be very hands-on and to be doing all of the customer interviews at the first demos that we gave, I built the prototype for the product in PowerPoint. And so that I just thought was cool, because if I didn't do it, no one else could do it. But I sort of managed to retain those skills by maybe having this innate fear of losing those skills at the bigger companies. And I think that's probably why I did quite well.
Probably one of the signals that people can lean on to know whether you're more wired as an entrepreneur or founder, because you have that urge to, you know, actually doing things and seeing things not from the backseat, but, you know, front
seat. Yeah, I think, you know, my career, I've sort of bounced between, I started off as an engineer and then bounced back and forward between marketing roles and sort of product or general manager type roles. And I think in the marketing roles in particular, there's a lot of activities where on day one, you don't know, it's a blank sheet of paper. Like, hey, we're going to do a launch. Okay, what are we launching? Well, we don't know yet. Where are we going to launch it? Well, yeah, we don't know that. Okay, who's going to be speaking? Well, we don't know that yet. What's the messaging? Well, we don't know that yet. But you need a plan and you need dates. And it's sort of a book it and they will come moment. I spent enough time in marketing to get very comfortable with like a blank sheet of paper and like, oh yeah, we need to have a plan of the things that we're going to go do, but it doesn't necessarily matter right now that we don't know how everything's going to play out. Let's just jump in and roll with it and we'll figure it out on the way. And I really look back at my career and feel like the time I spent in marketing got me very comfortable with that mode of operation. I would tell you, when I came to Observe in the founding team, even we had engineers that were very, very comfortable, almost empowered by a blank sheet of paper. And we also had some engineers that were terrified by it. And sort of to your point, not every person, every engineer is I think suited to a startup. I think you've got to get very comfortable with the blank sheet of paper and the unknown, and not been afraid to dive in and get it wrong. And for me, at least in my career, I think marketing helped me get comfortable with that probably better than any other thing that I've done.
Really love that, because the comfort level you have is unknowns or don't have control and figure things out. People get excited about it, or people can get really terrified.
No, I was gonna say that. I think I know if there's something that we haven't figured out, I know we can figure it out, right? I know why, because I've done it many times before. And I know we get some folks in here and there, I don't know, they were born like that. They just have this innate confidence and they believe they can do anything. I was always pretty confident, but I think because I've stuck at companies quite a long time and I've seen it through tough times and good times, I think when you go through a tough time or when something's difficult to figure out, I don't know, I always have this innate confidence of like, yeah, we'll figure it out. You know, let's get the right people around the table. Let's get the discussion out there. Let's figure out what we need to do, and then we'll figure it out. And so the nice thing sort of doing the startup at this stage of my career, because things go wrong every day, right? But things going wrong doesn't freak me out probably the way it did 10, 15, 20 years ago even. I'm like, all right, well, let's roll with it. Let's get to the bottom of it. Let's figure it out. You get the right people. You know, anything's solvable.
I want to zoom into this meeting because I think like the case where you're dealing with maybe a team where some folks are operating with more comfort and ambiguity and other folks maybe have less comfort. I was wondering if you could zoom us into this meeting. So for you, like, how do you approach this in a way that will help folks become better at operating in ambiguity or to be able to be okay with some of that uncertainty? Like, is there a way you structure that meeting? Is there a way that you approach or set constraints so that people feel like the mental freedom to think or be in sort of that unknown space? Like, what does that conversation look like when you're getting ready to enter in that type of conversation?
I think what's difficult about very early stage startups is your entire team needs to be comfortable with the unknown. And that can be very difficult because candidly, if there are folks that are not comfortable with that and they're not going to jump in, they're probably not a good fit for the team. And one of the most difficult things I did, you know, 7 months after I joined Observe was we cut a chunk of the team. We're a very small company. We were 15 people and we cut the team back to 9. And that's not because we had bad engineers on the team. They're actually excellent engineers, but you need drivers at the early stage and everybody's got to be able to drive. It's very, very difficult if you've got maybe half the team that are drivers and half aren't at that early stage, because the half that aren't, they're going to feel left out and you're not at the stage where you've got sort of mature engineering managers who can spend time to coach and mentor and all of that kind of stuff. You know, we have that now in the company. You know, we're 150 people, but I think it's incredibly difficult early on. And I also feel the superpower that a startup has is they've got a higher percentage of drivers in the team than the large organization. You know, when I think about the large organizations that I've had, it's not to say that I didn't have drivers in some of those teams, but if you look at the percentage of drivers, there's nowhere near as many because the product line is at a later stage. There's maybe not as much requirement to drive. There's much more a requirement to sort of maintain and incrementally improve. And I think that is ultimately why a lot of bigger companies get disrupted. You know, it's sort of the circle of life in software. So back to your question, it's very hard to coach someone who is intimidated by the unknown or afraid of the unknown. It's very hard to coach in a short period of time to get them comfortable with that. It comes over time as you engage on more projects and you then reflect how the project started, how it was maybe in the middle, and then how it completed in the end. It's a there's sort of a point of reflection. And once you've been through that cycle a few times, you get very, very comfortable. And I would say to folks who are maybe not comfortable with that, there is nothing wrong with going to a bigger company early in your career and learning this cycle and seeing how things work. Because once you've seen the cycle a couple of times, you get more comfortable with it. And then I would say if you're not naturally going to go after the blank sheet of paper, that there is a way to get comfortable with. But joining an early stage startup is not a way to get comfortable with. It's maybe even a way to destroy your confidence completely. It's always good to know yourself, you know?
I want to dive a little bit deeper into maybe what this lesson was for you, because at the beginning you had mentioned at one point there was this sort of fear of instability or the risk assessment was hard to think about transitioning from a larger company to a smaller company. And so like, what were maybe some of those cycles for you that created that confidence to operate in that more ambiguous environment?
Yeah, I think two things. I grew over time just incredibly frustrated with the larger organization. There's times when I've had like a third or a half the company even, and yet I didn't feel satisfied with my contribution. The desire to go to a smaller company was born out of a frustration of not being able to get the satisfaction out of my job at a larger company. I didn't feel like I was making the kind of contribution I could. I was not satisfied with the kind of work I was doing. The kind of the work I was doing was maybe interesting earlier in my career, but I'd done it many times before and it became repetitive. And I've always done my best, I think, when I've gotten outside my comfort zone and gone to something I've never done before. I mean, I started in engineering and went into tech support, and then I went into pre-sales, and then I went into marketing, and then, you know, I went into general management. And so I've sort of got this thing in me where I get bored maybe easily with a particular, when I think I've learned a particular role, I get bored and I go looking for something different. And so I think I'd gotten to that point just with bigger companies in general, and always had this fascination of what it would be like to be at a startup. But I think, look, it's also worth knowing I did quite well at large companies and I made enough money to be financially comfortable to take the risk and not have to worry about the family. And I think this doesn't maybe get talked about often enough. You get paid well at larger companies. You can afford a nice house, and this is the great thing about the tech industry, but you become a little bit trapped, right? You're comfortable, but you then can't take the drop in the standard of living for you and your family to go make, you know, whatever, 200 grand a year as an engineer at a startup or even as a CEO at a startup with the hope of building something great and making a lot more in 10 years' time. I mean, the time horizon on a startup, I started here in 2018. So I've been here almost 6 years. And our revenue this year is double digits, but that's 6 years in, you know, and you think to an IPO, if we keep growing at the rate we are, we probably got another 5 years. So it's a decade long commitment and you give up a lot. And so that for a lot of people is a difficult decision to make. But I really wanted to get back to something where I could be hands on, see something built from scratch. I felt like I'd spent too much of my career fixing other people's problems. And, you know, it was time to go create a few problems of my own that my younger self from 20 years ago can come along and fix when I'm done here, you know.
I love that sentiment. I'm tired of solving other people's problems. It's time to create my own.
I had this discussion with Michael Dell when I left. I mean, Michael was one of the great, when I was at EMC, we were acquired by Dell. And getting to know Michael was one of the big, big upsides of that merger. And, you know, and I remember talking to Michael when I was leaving, and we got on very well. And, you know, he's quite sort of sad to see us go. And I'm like, but Michael, like, you've done your thing. You've got Dell on the company and you've built this amazing company, and you know you can build something from scratch. I don't. And so this is what I want to go do. You know, Michael still got very much, you know, entrepreneur in him. I think he saw where I was coming from on that. But yeah, this is my sort of attempt, if you like, to prove that I can not just jump on someone else's train as it's going 70 miles an hour down the tracks. It's, can you get the train built and moving out the station?
Exactly why the investor friend, he was successful convincing you to join early stage company, because you wanted to be able to influence to see how things, decisions are made and architecture are designed from very early on. How did it evolve from the past 6 years and now again the next 5 years?
Yeah, the amazing thing is there's sort of this almost romantic view of startups that a lot of people have, because you hear about the IPO stories and, you know, oh, we almost went out of business, but then, you know, we whatever signed a term sheet and then we took off from there. And but it's really, really hard. Like when you arrive, I mean, there's nothing. There's no momentum. There's no product. And I remember as we started sort of coding on the product, probably 2 months in, it dawned on Jacob, who was one of our co-founders. He was like, okay, yeah, what development process are we going to use? And how are we going to organize what people are building when? And at the bigger companies, there's a process for everything and there's a system for everything. And obviously you jump into a startup and there's nothing, absolutely nothing. And so, yeah, like, yeah, what is the process? Like, are we going to meet on a Monday? And then what's on the list? You start everything from sort of first principles. And the empowering thing about it, or the nice thing about it, is nothing has been defined. And you sort of bring with you some experiences and some best practices, but it's like, okay, there's no right answer here. We can do this however we want. What would be the way that we want to do it that best suits us? And just even doing the basics of getting the dev process up and running, and what systems are we going to use to whatever track the enhancements that we want to make, and all of that takes energy. And this is why, you know, you've got to have a set of people who are going to dive in and self-start, because no one's going to tell you, hey, do this or do that. You've got to figure out what you don't have and go do it. Because if you don't do it, no one else is going to. I think once you get past that initial phase and you're working on the initial product, you start to think about, well, okay, like, when would we ship this product? Like, what does the MVP look like? Who would buy this? And at what point do we hire a salesperson? You know, because at some point we want to sell it. Do we wait until we've got the product and then hire someone? Or do we hire someone when there's nothing to sell? And if there's nothing to sell, then what's that person going to do? So there's all of these things that they're not even a discussion in a bigger company. But there's all of these nuances. We were like, okay, we'll do usage-based pricing. Okay, great. Let's do usage-based pricing. Okay, what does that mean? And how do people manage usage? If usage is too high, then what do we do? And then can the customer go in and see their usage? And how do we meter usage in the product? And then the billing system, does that do usage-based pricing or just subscriptions? You know, all of it, nothing is easy, is what I'd say. Like, nothing is easy. And no matter how hard you think or easy a particular task is, it's always harder. There's always more to it. And the other thing I'd tell you is every feature that we've built, every feature, when we thought we got it right, we got it wrong. I do think at times, how can this be? We've got a pretty experienced team. It's not like it's their first rodeo. They've written software before. How can we always get it wrong? And I think this is one of the great things about a startup, which, again, I think you lose in the bigger companies, is you can become very sort of dialed in to what the buyer wants, and that there's no layers between engineering and the customer. And if you set the right environment, I feel like my job is to create this environment in the company where it's very healthy for salespeople to introduce engineers directly to customers and to work with them and to make the product better. Once you get that, that's where the magic happens. Because engineers, I mean, they're smart, and they're not, you know, they hear a customer say, oh yeah, I do, this is the way I work. I click this, this, and this, and then that didn't work. They're like, oh my God. And it's fixed in no time. And so I feel like one of the most rewarding things that we've got in the phase that we're in right now is a lot of the sort of initial process stuff is up and running and going, and we don't worry so much about it. But you're in that sort of almost magical time where you've got a real product, but it's not perfect, but you've got customers who are prepared to bet on you, and they'll help you make the product better. And I feel like that connection that the engineering team have to the field organization is something we've got to hold on to for our entire, the entire life of the company, because I think that gets lost in a lot of bigger organizations and they become very disconnected. And that's when I think bad things start to happen.
I think the bet and trust from the customer, a nascent product that are new to market, that haven't a lot of proof yet, but it does solve a problem, like, better than any other product out there. So there's a lot of that direct connection with the customers and their trust. They're almost betting the company, and that it's emotional and personal in certain respect, and that's attractive to a lot of people.
Yeah, I mean, and I've been surprised, actually. Our biggest customer is Capital One, and they've been amazing. I mean, that's a big organization that really has leaned in on helping us define the product. And, you know, I believe they badly want us to be successful. And I feel like that alone then is motivating to the engineering team, because it's like, look, this is the list of things. If we solve this list of stuff, then that's going to keep this, huge corporation happy. And by the way, if we solve problems for them, there's probably another 10, 50, 100 organizations like them that we can solve the problem for. I remember when I started off as an engineer back in the UK, I worked for a company called ICL, and I joined out of school as a C programmer. And for the first 2 years, I was a programmer, and I never met a customer really. And I didn't even know where the code that I was writing ended up. Like, which product did it go into? It was a layer of a much bigger application that the company was building. But I think that gets a little bit soul destroying. You don't really know the end user. There's no gratification that the work that you're doing is actually solving a problem or contribute to the success of the company. And for me, at least, that is one of the great things about the smaller organization is you can tangibly see sort of cause and effect, right? We put this feature in, and this is the effect it had on that organization. And then, hey, at the end of the year, we get this deal, and that's what we use to hire more people and make the company more successful. So at this stage, at least, it's very apparent,
This is a conversation going to inspire a lot of people in our audience to start thinking about joining an early startup company or building their own. But there are still a lot of people working at a large company, and they are making a lot of contributions. So for them, based on your contrast of experience, how do you encourage them to best leverage their leadership influence to maybe connect their team closer to the outcome or to the end customer so that they got motivated? Like, have a taste of what do you have now?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's not to say that this can't be done in a larger organization. I think it is incumbent on the leaders in those organizations to get very, very close to the sales team. Once you're close to the sales team, by definition, I think you're close to the customer. There's then a job of listening. And I always feel like, look, for the customers that are most forward-looking or the customers that are perhaps, you know, largest from a revenue standpoint, what are the things that they want? And if you can adjust your roadmap to deliver ahead of time on the things that some of these larger folks want, they'll be blown away. The engineering team will be blown away as to the impact. That sounds trivial, by the way. But my observation is on our Observe roadmap, 90% of it is driven by what the current customers were selling to or asking us for. That's partly the phase that we're in, but 90% of it. And every week that list is triaged and reprioritized. And every day work is handed out to engineers. And so I'd say the operational cadence is much more intense and hands-on at our stage. There's no reason why that couldn't be recreated in a larger company. I mean, we call it the war room here, but you can create a war room inside a larger company. You can have a leader. You can decide which customers are going to contribute to either the bugs that need to be fixed or the feature enhancements. You can pull the right engineers into that war room. The key thing about it is you sort of cut out a lot of the management chain, right? And you say, oh, wait a minute. Like, can you do that in a large organization? Well, yeah, you're going to ruffle some feathers, but what do you want to do? Do you want to do something different and impactful for the customer, or do you want to keep the management chain happy? Because by the way, I think the management chain will buy into this if the goal or the vision for the program is explained. Try and get the cadence or the mode of operation of the larger organization down to how a startup works, not for everything, but maybe for a particular product line with a particular set of customers. Make a big impact in 60 or 90 days and see how your customers and your sales team, by the way, react to that. So I would say, you know, that it's not impossible to do, but it does take leadership and it takes a little bit of shaking the tree, because you are going to flatten the war room. The engineers who are working on the code, either fixing bugs or working on enhancement requests, they're in the war room. Their manager can be in the war room, but their manager doesn't get to say what they work on. The war room dictates that and the priority of items. So you can bring that to bear on larger organizations. That's one tactic that I would strongly recommend developing a muscle around. The second thing, from just a pure innovation standpoint, I've had sort of two runs at this. One is when you have overlapping product lines and you have dated product lines, it's not a ridiculous thought to say, why don't we build a new product line, right? Why don't we ultimately put these product lines into maintenance mode and build something new? The challenge with that is, obviously, I think it takes quite a bit of courage in a large organization to do that. Number two, you've got to keep it a secret, because otherwise all of the other organizations will try and kill it. So you've got to start it up with a very small team and incubate it, right? Five or 10 people, and get to the MVP with a very small team and don't tell anyone about it. And then once it starts to get to the MVP stage, you can start to add people from those other teams to the new product line, which, by the way, is motivating for them. I'm working on the new thing. And also you can then explain the sort of vision to those teams to say, look, ultimately, you guys are all going to be on the new thing, right? But we have to gracefully sunset the old thing first. And that, my opinion, that is not done often enough in large organizations. A, it takes courage. B, you've got to shake the tree. And C, it does take time. A big company can't do in 2 years what a startup can do in 10, but they always think they can. Oh, we've got a big sales team. We'll just build this thing and, you know, a couple of years, and it never happens. And the reason is because it takes a little bit of time to get the product right. And the worst thing you can do with a bad product is have a good marketing and sales team, right? And which a lot of big companies do. They have money to spend on marketing and they have a big sales team. So you've got to incubate it. You've got to keep it small. You've got to work with the customer. You've got to get to your MVP. But I do buy into the fact that if you can get it right at a large organization, your distribution channel is so big, you can scale products much more quickly than a startup.
people need to nail the product first and before they can scale.
Yes. And by the way, that is, I hear so many times, both in startups and bigger companies, oh, we have a sales execution issue. And at times it is a sales execution issue, but it's mostly the product. In a startup, an early stage startup, if your early sales team is not successful, it's never the sales team. It's always the product. And I would also tell you, you know, where bigger companies have built new products, they've probably taken it to market too soon. And the salespeople will take it to a mature account. It won't be as mature as the other products. The customer will complain. The salespeople will hate it. It'll get a bad name and then it'll get killed. That's the typical mode of operation that I've seen in a large company, which is why you've got to sort of keep it a secret till you've got the MVP, then work with a small set of customers and set the right expectation. But when you get it right, you've immediately got a distribution channel like you can scale. But I mean, you're 100% right. It's not all about the product, but 80% of it is. If you get that right, you can scale it. If you get it wrong, you'll never scale it, and you'll just create a whole bunch of problems in your customer base.
Is the dynamic going on behind the scenes when you're talking about like the incentives for organizations to try to kill the new project? Is that because it's sort of trying to preserve like their own like power within the company? Like, what are the dynamics that are kind of causing like that force?
I mean, I've been at a few big companies, but like war breaks out. Like, what, you're building a new product that does what we do? Then it becomes competitive. Product lines are way more competitive internally than they are with their competition in the open market, has been my observation. I mean, one level, it's human nature. You know, if I've been working on the core product line that made this company great, but it's long in the tooth, its architecture's outdated, and you start to build a new one, it's like, oh, wait a minute. What are those guys doing? We can do what they do. It's a good way to spur innovation in an older team, by the way, but it becomes dysfunctional because they end up being competitive and the older team tries to kill the newer one before the newer team has actually gotten anything. And I mean, certainly this has happened at all the big companies over the years. I mean, I think Microsoft, I remember reading, you know, Windows versus Azure, you know, sort of the old OS versus the OS for the cloud. At Oracle, this was the case. And I think one of the things Larry did over the years was he would deliberately create competing projects. He liked the idea that people would compete. So he would kick off two or three projects. And hey, if worst case, if I get three that are great, then that's better than one, right? It creates kind of a very dysfunctional culture internally, not a pleasant culture to be within. And I remember, at EMC, a guy actually who's still at Dell, Jeff Boudreau, did a masterful job of this. We had three or four different mid-range storage product lines. And Jeff created a new product line, which today is known as PowerStore. And I think we started it around the time that we were thinking of merging with Dell, because we had three mid-range products and Dell had two. So we're like, okay, five would not be good. Maybe we should have one. But Jeff did a masterful job of creating a new product, a unified product, and putting a handful of folks on it. But it took him the best part of 7 or 8 years to get that product to market. And now they've got it right. I think that product line is probably scaling faster than any they've had in the company's history. So it can be done. You got to be patient and it takes time. And as I said, I think Jeff deserves a lot of credit for having the courage to make the move.
Well, I think so. As you're mentioning, like Jeff being able to do this like over a 7 to 8 year period, like were there certain qualities or characteristics that you think led to success there? Either like in how Jeff like approached it as a leader or like some of the dynamics that he was able to create within the different lines of the company?
The main thing was his sort of frustration or impatience dealing with lots of product lines with lots of legacy code that you could never coalesce. And so, you know, your options are keep doing that forever and having the good people on those teams get more disillusioned and the sales team get more frustrated because the pace of innovation isn't what it needs to be because there's multiple code bases. And so, look, he made the call like, we're going to do something new. And as I said, that takes courage because people might not like it. It could go wrong. We don't have incremental funding for it. You've got to sort of change the wheel on the car while the car's going 70 miles an hour down the road. But I put it down to character. Like he was a strong enough character with enough sort of courage of his convictions to say, God damn it, we're going to do it. I'm going to get my best people on this new thing. I'm going to get everybody thinking in a new direction. And then it's a job of management to sort of move resources from those teams over time. Like, hey, finish the job on this code base and then we'll move you on to the new one. But I think it's very difficult to do. But as I said, given the size of big tech companies these days, it's a skill that every big tech company needs to develop because everybody's going to have legacy code bases and everybody's going to see that they need to re-architect for the future. And I almost feel like it has to become a core competence.
you know, at the very beginning of our conversation, you mentioned like the reason why you felt like you did well in a larger context was because you were able to work through the hierarchy and you went direct to the person doing the job. And then you shared the story of creating the war room for a larger company and how that could be a pathway for innovation and launching new products within a larger company, but it might ruffle some feathers. The objective or goal to help somebody become more effective in that type of environment where maybe hierarchy means there's like personality or feathers to be ruffled. What recommendations do you have for somebody to be able to go direct to the person doing the job to help get things moving and also manage other relationships at play that may be either like offended or maybe that's not the right word, but like, you know, how do you be effective at influencing this outcome here to go direct?
Look, I think you've got to have like a strong conviction about what the right thing to do is. The attributes that I've been able to develop over the years, or I've always been probably pretty good at, is just clarity of thought. What are the top three things that we need to do? The bigger the company, by the way, the more important it is to get those top three things nailed. And then it's about, okay, the thought is great, but then what really is important is sort of thought to action. Like how long before that thought becomes action? And I found the best way to do that was to get more people in the room. There's been a lot written about not having big meetings. I kind of liked big meetings because I could get everyone on the same page, obviously in big companies. But I always felt like it's up to me to conduct the orchestra. It's up to me to lead. And if I can't explain the rationale, then shame on me. You know, I always felt like I needed to be able to justify my actions or explain my actions. You know, some people, I think some management styles are sort of like do as I say. And I've never really subscribed to that. It's like, look, do as I say because this, right? The because this is actually more important than the do as I say. And I always felt like if I've got good rationale, then I can rally people towards a better place. And so I always felt like it was much better to inspire people to a better place than it was to browbeat them to a better place. And the difference between the two is just explaining your rationale. If you're afraid of, like, I shouldn't have to explain, or maybe if your motivations are bad, then maybe you're scared to explain. But if your motivations are good, why shouldn't you give people the story behind the decision? If it's logical and it makes sense, then you can rally them. And that's the power of a big organization. If you get people marching in the same direction. So I would sort of say to leaders, like clarity of thought on what are your top X things. Don't be afraid then to inspire the organization and tell them why. Be brutally honest about why. No one wants to hear that the architecture is not for the long term. They probably know that. They're probably sitting there by the water cooler every day saying, oh, this isn't, you know, our architecture is not as good as this new startup that we're competing with. They know it. So go and tell them it. So I always felt like I never was saying things that people didn't know. I was just saying things that people didn't say. There's something therapeutic about saying things that people already know. Most of the time, most reasonable people will get on board and rally behind it.
Those kind of conversations are the real progresses. Getting people aligned, marching towards a new direction now. But those things won't happen until we have clarity.
Yeah, and the fear, I think, with younger managers is, but if some people don't buy in, they might leave. And I think as you get a little bit older, wiser, you don't care about that so much. It's like, all right, if you want to leave, leave. If you're not on board with the mission, we don't need you anyway. You're probably just going to be detracting from the mission and undermining the people who want to be on it. And as a manager and a leader, there are moments in your career where you are required to do that. And the leaders who are not effective, they sort of shirk that responsibility of being honest with people and inspiring the people who want to go to a better place for fear of pissing off the people who don't want to come on the journey anyway. So I've always felt like, yeah, you get to these points in time where it's decision time and are you going to do it? A lot of leaders, they know the right decision. They just don't always make it. And they don't always make it for fear of being unpopular. But I think in the medium term, my experience has been that leads to discontent. If you've got an unhappy organization sort of doing nothing or not attacking the problem, doesn't lead to a happy organization. I think decision points and how you approach those is sort of key.
How do you connect that to the experience of building the largest community in the world? Because community, you have little control over the people that are part of the community. So they are voluntarily joining the community, want to engage, they're coming out of their own mind. So a leading community is really a real test for leadership. So how do you connect those two parts?
Yeah, that's a good one. I mean, Oracle Technology Network. It was an online community before really online communities were a thing. Was the OG, or one of the OGs. Because I'd been an engineer, I was very frustrated by the way Oracle approached developers. And Oracle was very much sort of a top-down, go sell to the CIO, sell high organization. They didn't cater to developers and have developers fall in love with their technology and work it bottom up. And frankly, I was always sort of envious of what Microsoft did. I mean, back in the 90s, I was a member of Microsoft Developer Network, which I just thought was the greatest thing ever. And so I had quite a strong conviction that we were doing it wrong. I knew that the right way to do it, what developers wanted is they wanted something for free. They wanted our software for free. Why? Because if they had our software for free, they could build applications and do all kinds of amazing things without talking to an Oracle salesperson. I got into a position in Oracle where I could influence this. I was the VP of marketing for developer tools. The developer program had been wandering around the Alliances organization. We had salespeople trying to sell Oracle to developers instead of selling it to CIOs, which is a total waste of time and a total disaster. And so they gave us the program. You know, I remember the recommendation to make it successful was to change the name of it because, you know, it had such a bad reputation. And I was like, no. Like, okay, so just to prove you guys wrong, I'm not going to change the name of it. So I kept the name the same. But I went to Larry Ellison and said, Larry, we need to give our software away to developers. And I mean, at the time, I was in my early 30s. I think I was 31. And funnily enough, Larry, he actually understands more than you think about the developer mindset. I mean, in my entire career, I never saw him happier than when he was sitting with the database development team, shooting the breeze with them. And he was like, well, look, let's create a license. Let's allow them to steal. Let's make it legal to steal it. Let's create a developer license. And so so that's what we did. We created a license such that if you wanted to download Oracle software, you could. You had to click something to say that you wouldn't use it for commercial use. And so it essentially allowed developers to steal the software. But for me, that was critical because free software for developers, there is no better offer. Right, developers don't want to pay for software. And then I went after the engineering teams and said, look, can we publish the bug database? Again, what do developers want? They don't want to talk to support. They want to look it up themselves. So I got permission from the engineering teams to sanitize the bug database and publish that. People that were in the community allow them to interact through threaded discussion forums. And I got folks in the engineering teams to answer questions on there. So again, for building a community, I think you've got to establish trust and it's got to be authentic. And so for me, establishing trust was, let me give you some valuable stuff that you would have had to pay tens of thousands of dollars for. Let me give you it for free. It's Oracle software. It's the bug database. It's the documentation. It's essentially support through threaded discussion forums. You can have it all for free. You don't have to buy anything. And I think that established a level of trust. And we did not, for the first 2 years, we did not give the names of anyone who downloaded anything to the inside sales team. Because again, if you right away, if the first thing you do is send salespeople after someone who's downloaded, they're just going to get pissed off with it. So I felt like, okay, we've got to establish trust. We've got to show them that we're serious. And then we've got to give these folks a path to be successful. So then we started introducing a certification program. So, you know, hey, we'll certify your skills on Oracle. You can then have a qualification that you can put on your resume or now your LinkedIn, which shows that you've reached a certain standard. So for me, the community building, it was the exact opposite of what Oracle did for the previous 20 years. It was about giving things away and writing free technical content to explain to folks how to build applications and take advantage of the platform. And the other thing that blew me away about it is it wasn't a huge investment, right? I mean, it was, again, I had to go and change a couple of things in the company. Can we give away free software? Can I get the bug database? But I was pretty good at making the case that if we were to be successful in this sort of web era of computing in the late 90s that was been driven by developers, if we didn't do that, we were going to get left in the dust. And you know, thankfully enough people bought into it. But I think communities, you know, you've got to establish trust. You've got to be authentic in the interaction. People can smell BS. If it's a clickbait or if it's articles that are not valid, marketing people cannot write the articles for the developer community. Developers don't want to speak to marketing people. They want to hear from engineering folks. So I hired a bunch of technical folks that wrote articles about building applications on top of Oracle. So if the voice isn't authentic, then to the community, whatever that community is, then you're never going to build a community. That was really the difference. And as you said, you're right. I couldn't tell them, hey, you will join our community. I had to show them that there was enough things there and that we were sort of legit enough for them to invest time. credit where credit's due. It was myself and a guy called René Bonvenu. And René Bonvenu, I don't know whether you know René, he's an amazing gentleman. He did very well at Palo Alto Networks, but I've worked with René several times over the years, and he's one of the greatest marketers that understands developers I've ever met.
Jeremy, are you ready to jump in for some rapid-fire questions?
Sure, let's do it.
What are you reading or listening to right now?
Believe it or not, I read everything online. I don't read books. I watch a ton of movies, and I listen to music.
Well, you got to give us a movie recommendation now, or a music recommendation.
Movie recommendation, obviously, Top Gun was the greatest movie ever made. Top Gun Maverick is a worthy successor, and I've watched it about 10 times. That's fantastic. And you know what? Music. I went to a Taylor Swift concert. Listen to Taylor Swift if you haven't listened to Taylor Swift. I was blown away. I thought Taylor was not, she was not my kind of music person. But I went with my daughter to the concert, and I loved it. So, hey, go Taylor Swift. And she won the Super Bowl.
I watched the Eras Tour Netflix concert series, and I can, you know, confirm it is, in fact, a transcendent experience. I would categorize it at that level, like absolutely powerful. Next question. What's a tool or methodology that's had a big impact on you?
Actually, the war room methodology that I outlined is a game changer. We stole it from our head of engineering is Chi Jin, and who came from Stripe. He ran engineering at Stripe. It is essential for every startup. Tool, I mean, hey, Slack. I used to dread getting home and having 200 emails to get through. We have a Slack culture. I barely do email internally.
Next question. What's a trend that you're seeing or following that's been interesting or hasn't hit the mainstream yet?
I mean, obviously, GPT is hit. I don't know whether it's in mainstream use. I'm bullish on GPT. It still remains to be seen which are the killer applications and where its main uses. And I think it's going to be a bolt on. It's going to make a thing better, not be a thing in and of itself. It's sort of why I don't think it's mainstream yet. It's sort of a lot of hype and a lot of BS, but I think it's got real mainstream implications to make a process that you have already automated better.
An interesting perspective, a seamless integration across a different experience versus an experience in and of itself.
Right. I mean, it's fun to go ask silly questions of ChatGPT, but that's not really that useful. You know, if you've got an existing application or existing process or something, I think you can lower the barrier entry and change the interaction model. But I think it can make a thing a lot richer and easier to use.
Last question, Jeremy. Is there a quote or a mantra that you live by or a quote that's been really resonating with you right now?
Oh, I've got lots. One of my favorite leaders is Colin Powell, and he's got these 17 lessons in leadership. And the man in the field is right on the rear echelon is wrong unless proved otherwise. Because as a product person, you always think you're right in what you're building. And the reality is you're never right. And so trust the person in the field and listen. So I think that's where the magic happens in particularly enterprise software startups. If you can listen to the man in the field, and even if you're the rear echelon, you won't go far wrong.
The final thing I wanted to relate with what you shared and sort of a theme that I picked up on is like for folks listening into this, like they're probably from a couple different perspectives, whether in a startup, internal startup within, you know, a massive organization or a leader within, you know, a massive organization. What stood out to me was how much you recognize that it takes courage to do something new. And so really like those two quotes, I think are so powerful to have the courage to go out and to do something new here. And so just want to say thank you for being that force to provide some really powerful approaches to do this at different levels.
Great. Thanks for the time, guys. Really enjoyed it.
If you enjoyed the episode, make sure that you click subscribe if you're listening on Apple Podcasts or follow if you're listening on Spotify. And if you love the show, we also have a ton of other ways to stay involved with the engineering leadership community. To stay up to date and learn more about all of our upcoming events, our peer groups, and other programs that are going on, head to sfelc.com. That's sfelc.com. See you next time on the Engineering Leadership Podcast.